Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank.
Hey everyone, welcome to today's episode. Today's episode has to do with the Civil War, and the topic comes from listener David Santee, who asks this question. I really enjoyed your Civil War series that you did, and I have a follow-up question with that. You mentioned that Union generals got better and Confederate generals got worse as the war went on. Can you follow up on that? All right, well, I love wide-open questions like this because it gives me a lot of leeway to take the question wherever I want to go. The issue of why Union generals tended to get better and Confederate generals tended to get worse as the war went on can be attributed to all sorts of issues. One is simple manpower. The Union Army had a much larger manpower supply, so at every single rank, from private up to general, there were simply more generals available. And in the first year or two of the war, the Union generals were not that great, at least those in command. They kept losing victories over and over again to Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and other figures. What I want to do in this episode is I want to zero in on a couple of character studies that perhaps can give a bigger picture understanding of this question. So first, I'll be looking at Robert E. Lee. And a lot of my information for this episode comes from the Edward Bonnekemper book, Myth of the Lost Cause, because Lee is a good stand-in for a lot of the issues that plague Union generals. It wasn't simply their ability to fight the war that made them better or worse. It was also the overall aims of the war, what Jefferson Davis was dictating on high. And it made it difficult for the Confederate generals to win battles, but still execute the strategy of the Confederacy, which was a little bit flawed. Then I'm going to jump ahead to an issue of the Union Army waging total war, because this tells us about Northern strategy as well. Now, when discussing Robert E. Lee, something I've mentioned many times before in this podcast is that he is difficult to separate myth from history because he's the patron saint of the lost cause of the Confederacy myth. It's a historical theory that holds the cause of the Confederacy was a just and heroic one, that it was a struggle for states' rights, for the Southern way of life in the face of overwhelming Northern aggression, and that the role of slavery wasn't really the purpose of the Civil War. But it was the constitutional right for states to determine law, and states were sovereign in the Federal Republic. And the way Robert E. Lee fits into this narrative is he was a genius general who should have won, and the only reason he didn't was due to overwhelming manpower numbers in the North. This view took hold shortly after Robert E. Lee's death in 1870, and many people soon after thought that Lee fought extremely well while Grant's armies were butchered by Grant's own aggressiveness. The approach has been to emphasize Lee's victories in 1862 and 1863, the period where Lee was highly successful, and that ties into our question why Confederate generals were so good in the beginning. Then they cast Antietam as a victory, but then they blame Lee's Gettysburg defeat on others, and they stress the heavy casualties he imposed on Grant's army in the 1864 Overland Campaign. Michael Fellman says that Lee's final general order to his army, praising their unsurpassed courage and fortitude, and asserting they had been forced to yield to overwhelming numbers and resources, was the beginning of the lost cause. He adds, "At the McLean House, suffering the physical death of military surrender, the Confederacy became immortal. Exactly here can one find the essential moment of origin of the lost cause, which Robert E. Lee was the effective first father. Southern white nationalism arose from the ashes of the lost cause, to a considerable extent because of the prideful spirit Lee both articulated and embodied. He was a sacrificial lamb, the Confederate Christ on the cross at Appomattox, who then was resurrected by others in the spirit and the body politic. Before he died, he also became the soft-spoken but implacable foe of submission and conciliation." The success of this pro-Lee campaign, notes John Keegan, is curious. He writes, "The only cult general in the English-speaking world, Robert E. Lee, was the paladin of its only component community to suffer military catastrophe, the Confederacy." After the Civil War, historians dealt with Lee as with most other participants in the war, treating him positively for the most part, but discussing his faults. The treatment was similar to newspapers' treatment of Lee during the war itself, when Stonewall Jackson rivaled or surpassed him as the most adored Confederate general. Both men were celebrated in death as martyrs for the Confederacy. The first historians after the war praised Lee, but found fault with his actions at Gettysburg and other battles, sometimes at Antietam, Fredericksburg, and the Seven Days Battle. Other Confederate generals like Jackson, Longstreet, Joseph Johnson, Albert Johnston, and other people that, if you really want to dig into their story, there's a 20-plus episode series I did with James Early, Key Battles of the Civil War. But anyway, among all the other Confederate generals, they generally received favorable treatment. Richard Ewell and Jubal Early were universally criticized for their timidity on the first day of Gettysburg. And one author, Edward Pollard, wrote in The Lost Cause in 1866 that Lee's influence on the Confederacy's fortunes was completely negative. But after his death in 1870, Lee became a Southern and then a national deity. The groundwork for that transformation was laid as early as 1868, when a Southern publication said he was bathed in the white light that falls directly upon him from the smile of an approving and sustaining God. By 1880, John Daniel, one of Early's former staff officers, wrote, "The divinity in Lee's bosom, shown translucent through the man and his spirit, rose up to the godlike." Christ-like images of Lee continued well into the 20th century in the writings of many other historians. One example of this deification is found at the end of Freeman's four-volume Ode to Lee, essentially his history of the Civil War, published in 1935. And if one, only one of all the myriad incidents of his stirring life had to be selected to typify his message as a man, the young Americans who stood in hushed awe that rainy October morning after his death, as their parents wept at the passing of the Southern Arthur, who would hesitate in selecting that incident? It occurred in Northern Virginia, probably on his last visit there. A young mother brought her baby to him to be blessed. He took the infant in his arms and looked at it and then at her and slowly said, "Teach him he must deny himself." So Lee was sort of a combination of King Arthur and Jesus. Another work that perpetuates the myth of Lee, the Encyclopedia of American Biography in 1974, calls him a rare example of a man who looked like a perfect soldier and was. He fought with the Confederacy, not because he loved warfare, but for Virginia and the abstract principle of states' rights. He was always outnumbered by the enemy, and usually short of food, equipment, and ammunition. He was able, without strain, to equate the effort for the Confederacy with the effort for Virginia. In sum, he was a marvelous soldier, cool, quick, decisive, resourceful, amazingly tactful in dealing with Jefferson Davis, and when defeat eventually faced him, a beautiful loser. Don't hear that phrase much. The one source provided for this analysis is Freeman's R.E. Lee. The myth continued for a quarter century when the Oxford Companion to American Military History in 1999 praised him as a man of high personal character and intelligence, charismatic and charming, a natural leader. As a leading actor in the Civil War legend of Marshall Glory, he's become a legendary figure, an American hero of exceptional nobility, it wrote. The legend rationalizes or rejects characteristics of the man that might lessen his appeal. So after a discussion of his critics' and defenders' contentions, the entry on Lee concludes, "Whatever his shortcomings, Lee became the White South's greatest hero, and many Northern and foreign commentators have praised both the man and the general." The preeminent literary monument to Lee is the classic seven volumes written by Douglas Freeman, the four-volume Pulitzer Prize-winning R.E. Lee, a biography, written in 1934 to 1935, and the three-volume Lee's Lieutenants, a study in command, written in the early 40s. During his 25 years of work on these studies, Freeman, the editor of the Richmond Newsleader, saluted Lee's statue each day as he went to work. As early as 1914, in an introduction to Lee's dispatches, Freeman had revealed his view of Lee. "He entered upon the year 1863 with a series of victories unbroken from the time he had taken command. He ended the year with the greatest opportunity of his career, lost through the blunders and worse of his subordinates. Lee seemed then the very incarnation of knighthood." So in these volumes, Lee is essentially perfect. He's a pure-blooded Virginian, the finest society America had ever produced. He was intelligent, unerring, and any faults he had almost made him greater. He was so tolerant of the faults of others that sometimes their mistakes would result in defeats for which Lee would be held responsible. And the works that praise Lee the most are usually based on this. So anyway, you get the idea. For a very long time, this was the narrative that held on Lee. Let's take a closer look at Lee's Civil War record. Now, it would be impossible for anyone to live up to that myth, and Lee's doesn't. He was a great general, don't get me wrong, but no one could be as good as the early myth about Lee was. So that's something to consider, because Confederate generals at the beginning of the war can be so mythologized that it seems like they have a terrible drop in quality as the war goes on, when maybe it's not really the case. The faults that they had at the beginning of the war were probably there at the end, and the strengths they had at the beginning of the war were probably there at the end as well. So after declining command of the Union Army because he wouldn't lift a sword against the Commonwealth of Virginia, and Lee joined the Confederacy, he did a great job of organizing the Virginia militia and defending the state in the early months of the war. As its militia became part of the Confederacy's army, Lee became President Jefferson Davis's military advisor. He was disappointed that he wasn't on the field for the Confederate victory at First Bull Run, known as the Battle of First Manassas, and Lee continued to lobby for a field command. His wish was granted when he was sent to northwestern Virginia in late 1861, but he demonstrated some of the weaknesses that would plague him throughout the war. At Cheat Mountain, he issued long, complicated orders and failed to exercise hands-on control. While in the small theater, he failed to deal with squabbling subordinates whose disputes were undermining Confederate efforts to regain control of northwestern Virginia, and he returned back to Richmond a failure. Davis then gave Lee a chance for redemption by assigning him to command the South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida coasts. First, Davis had to write letters to affected governors assuring them that Lee was indeed a highly competent general, contrary to what they may have heard about his Western Virginia experience. Lee did a great job building defensive coastal fortifications and withdrawing most of the rebel defenses to waters beyond the reach of Union gunboats. Apparently because Davis was becoming disenchanted with independent, uncooperative, and personally despised generals such as Joseph Johnston and P.T. Beauregard, he recalled Lee to Richmond as his primary military advisor once again. There, Lee helped Davis to pressure Johnston into more forceful defensive actions, especially after George P. McClellan started slowly moving up the Virginia Peninsula from the Norfolk area toward Richmond. After 2 months of dalliance, McClellan finally reached the vicinity of Richmond and split his army on both sides of the Chickahominy River. On May 31, 1862, with prodding, Johnston attacked an isolated portion of Little Mac's army on the southern side of the river. In what became the two-day Battle of the Seven Pines, Longstreet bungled his attack and reinforcements from the north of the river were able to avert a Union disaster. The most important result of the battle was that Johnston was badly wounded, and on June 1, 1862, Lee succeeded to command of the major Confederate army in the east, which he promptly dubbed the Army of Northern Virginia. His record as its commander requires deep examination before judgment can be rendered about the quality of his Civil War performance. Lee enhanced his early war reputation as the King of Spades by ordering his army to dig fortifications south of the Chickahominy between Richmond and McClellan's Army of the Potomac. Contrary to many people's expectations that he would be a cautious general, he was preparing for the first of many offenses against his foes. His strategic and tactical aggressiveness would soon be apparent to all. The 7 days battle ended McClellan's disastrous peninsula campaign, which began in late June and was Lee's first as army commander. Correctly predicting that McClellan would not have the moral courage to attack Lee's lines in Richmond while Lee moved his army to the north side of the Chickahominy, Lee took two-thirds of his army above the river and attacked Little Mac's largest corps, which was alone there. In a sign of things to come, Lee had his army attack the enemy for most of 1 week and push them away from Richmond and back to the James River. Although Lee knew that he had achieved a strategic objective of saving Richmond after 2 days of fighting, he continued his attack for days more, taking substantial casualties. He was a very offensive fighter. His army suffered 20,000 casualties, dead, wounded, missing, or captured, while McClellan suffered only 16,000, although keep in mind that there's probably not a Revolutionary War battle that had 16,000 casualties. Most of Lee's casualties were killed or wounded. Only 10,000 of Little Mac's were killed or wounded. That week of fighting was marked by McClellan's constant retreats under his usual misapprehension that he was outnumbered 2-1, and Lee's over-aggressiveness and mismanagement of his army. He generally issued a battle order for the day and then simply let things unfold without close battlefield control by him or his deliberately small staff. Virtually every daily order called for Stonewall Jackson to come in on Lee's left flank, and the rest of Lee's army diverted the Yankees' attention with frontal assaults. While these assaults resulted in horrendous casualties, Jackson was either a no-show or late show on almost every occasion. Lee took no corrective action. The final battle of the week was Malvern Hill, where a disorganized and disastrous rebel assault against a strong, elevated Union position resulted in such slaughter that D.H. Hill, one of Lee's generals, described it as not war, but murder. By then, Lee had so decimated and disorganized his army that McClellan's subordinates recommended an immediate counterattack to destroy Lee's army or capture Richmond. McClellan, of course, declined and retreated farther downriver. Lee's strategic victory made him an instant hero in the South, which was losing battles on most other fronts. However, he had demonstrated a proclivity for complicated and ambiguous orders, lack of battlefield control, and relentless offensive actions that resulted in irreplaceable casualties for the Confederacy, which was always at a manpower disadvantage compared to the Union. And many people think that the Confederacy could have won if they would have fought a carefully guarded war of attrition, but that's not how Lee fought. While McClellan, who was pouting at Harrison's Landing on the James River, kept requesting more reinforcements, Lee determined that the Army of the Potomac was no threat to Richmond and decided to go on the offensive again. He moved into central and northern Virginia to challenge John Pope's new Army of Virginia. With help from McClellan, who delayed sending reinforcements to Pope and kept 25,000 Union troops away from the battlefield, Lee won perhaps his greatest victory at Second Manassas. With Jackson on the defensive and Longstreet then overwhelming Pope's left flank, Lee suffered only 9,500 casualties to the Union Army's 14,400. With Lee present, Jackson inexplicably failed to leave his position and join Longstreet's attack. After a minor victory at Chantilly, Lee took unilateral action, approved neither by Davis nor the Confederate Congress or Cabinet, that proved devastating to rebel prospects. He crossed the Potomac and invaded the North in hopes of reaching Pennsylvania. In that campaign, the Antietam Campaign, he hoped to feed his army, gather thousands of recruits, and win a great victory that would dismay the Northern people and convince England and France to recognize the Confederacy. For about 3 weeks, Lee's army lived on non-Virginia soil, but he failed to gain recruits. He was in the western part of Maryland, where pro-slavery sentiment was weak, and those Marylanders interested in joining his army had already done so. More importantly, he squandered what had been a grand opportunity for European recognition. England and France had been poised to recognize the Confederacy until Lee's invasion, but they decided to wait for the outcome of his campaign. That campaign started well for Lee as he took advantage of McClellan's slow response to the discovery of Lee's lost order, which showed troop movements for Lee, and captured more than 11,000 Union soldiers at Harper's Ferry. Instead of declaring the campaign a success after the capture of Harper's Ferry and its garrison, Lee put his pitifully small and exhausted army in a trap at Sharpsburg, Maryland. In the Battle of Antietam on September 17th, he suffered severe losses and would have been destroyed by almost any general other than McClellan. McClellan was very slow, he was not aggressive at all, and he squandered almost every chance he came across. Lee's and Jackson's counterattacks at Miller's Cornfield in the early hours of the battle were acts of tactical suicide, not genius. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Although McClellan allowed Lee's army to escape, the Confederates had suffered a crushing strategic defeat that opened the door for Lincoln's preliminary Emancipation Proclamation on September 22nd, and virtually ended all hopes of European intervention. Lee's net casualties at Harper's Ferry had been over 11,500, but his army suffered 11,500 casualties in the rest of the Antietam campaign. After retreating to Virginia, Lee was a beneficiary of foolhardy Union assaults ordered by Ambrose Burnside at Mare's Height at Fredericksburg in December 1862. Lee's army, fighting from entrenched positions most of the day, inflicted almost 13,000 casualties on the Union attackers, while incurring a few more than 5,000 themselves. Although Lee wasn't satisfied with the defensive nature of the victory, it was sufficient to boost Southern morale for many months. The lesson of Fredericksburg was that a frontal assault on the enemy, if not absolutely necessary, was unwise, but Lee failed to learn it. After Stonewall Jackson's famous flanking maneuver at Chancellorsville in early May 1863, Lee spent the next couple of days frontally assaulting Joseph Hooker's Union lines. As a result, his army suffered almost 13,000 casualties while inflicting over 17,000 on the weakly led enemy. But Lee's army paid a price too high, including the loss of Jackson. But Lee's army paid too high a price for the Chancellorsville victory, the loss of Stonewall Jackson. Its butcher's bill would have been an even higher one had Lee been able to launch a planned frontal assault on another strong Union position. Lee was angry, but his subordinates were relieved when Hooker retreated across the Rapidune River before Lee could attack. And Gettysburg was even more disastrous for the Confederacy and the Army of Northern Virginia. By invading Pennsylvania, Lee deprived rebel armies in the other theaters of desperately needed reinforcements. Had Longstreet's troops reinforced a badly outnumbered Bragg against George Thomas's Tullahoma campaign, Thomas might have been prevented from crossing the Tennessee River and seizing Chattanooga, and more rebel troops might have been sent to oppose Grant's Vicksburg campaign. On the first day of the three-day battle at Gettysburg, Lee missed a grand opportunity to occupy the high ground, a failure that proved costly over the next 48 hours. Longstreet, his senior general, opposed Lee's plans for frontal assault on the second and third days against Union troops in strong defensive positions. That campaign cost Lee an intolerable 28,000 casualties, while the Union lost 23,000. As a result, Lee no longer had the strength to initiate strategic offenses, which had been a bad idea anyway, and more importantly, he lacked the manpower to counterpunch effectively when attacked. Some regard Gettysburg as a turning point of the war. Lost cause adherents have attempted to make it the turning point and have expended considerable effort attempting to relieve Lee of responsibility for that major tactical and strategic defeat. Their position is that Longstreet lost Gettysburg and thus the war, while Lee was blameless. Most Lee apologists found the only scapegoat they needed in James Longstreet. Because the Lee-Longstreet saga has become such a fundamental part of the myth, most of the books focus on this relationship. The cumulative casualties of 1862 and 1863 took a severe toll on Lee's army, both in the number and the quality of the men lost. It was a toll on the Confederacy, outnumbered almost 4-1 at the war's outset, and they couldn't afford to keep this up. With an army that was merely a shadow of the one that he inherited, Lee was finally forced to fight in a truly defensive style in opposing Grant's overland campaign of 1864. Staying generally on the defensive at the Wilderness, Spotsylvania Courthouse, North Anna River, and Cold Harbor enabled Lee to post the kind of numbers he had needed in prior years. Before Grant had reached the James River, Lee lost only 33,000 men while inflicting 55,000 casualties on the Army of the Potomac. But for Lee, it was too little, too late. He had so weakened his army with his offensive strategies and tactics in 1862 and 1863 that he couldn't prevent Grant from forcing him into a partial siege situation at Richmond and Petersburg, in which Lee's army was doomed. He continued to focus solely on his own army as the rest of the Confederacy was collapsing. The Overland Campaign of 1864, in which Grant, according to his critics, took too many casualties, ironically shows what Lee could have accomplished had he stayed on the strategic and tactical defense in 1862 and 1863. As Alan Nolan concludes, the truth is that in 1864, Lee himself demonstrated the alternative to his earlier offensive strategy and tactics. Grady McWiney reaches the same conclusion. Though Lee was at his best on defense, he adopted a defensive strategy only after attrition had deprived him of the power to attack. His brilliant defensive campaign against Grant in 1864 made the Union pay in manpower as it had never paid before. But the Confederates adopted defensive tactics too late. Lee started the campaign with too few men, nor could he replace his losses, as could Grant. So what they're saying here is, had Lee used a different strategy at the beginning of the war, perhaps the Confederacy could have won. He knew how to fight a defensive war that could inflict more casualties on the Union, and that's all he had to do. The Confederacy had to inflict enough casualties on the Union to dispirit them, much as the Colonials had done against the British in the Revolutionary War, but he didn't. So this is an interesting turn where some people think that Confederate generals get worse as the war goes on, where the strategies that needed to be used to win were used later in the war by the Confederacy, but by then it was too late. Now, there are a lot of things that you can criticize about Lee, that he was too aggressive, like I mentioned, that his orders were indirect, that his lieutenants couldn't execute his orders well. I'm just going to focus on one other shortcoming, And I don't want to be too hard on Lee because he was a great general in many ways, but that has been said many other places elsewhere. So I want to try to balance this out a little bit. Let me just mention a bit on his loss of battlefield control. Lee's own explanation of his battlefield management sheds a good deal of light on his too frequent loss of control on the battlefield. He said he tried to make his plan as good as my human skill allows, but their implementation suffered. He said, "I plan and work with all my might to bring the troops to the right place at the right time. With that, I have done my duty. As soon as I order the troops forward into battle, I lay the fate of my army at the hands of God. Then," he said, "it is my general's turn to perform their duty." So he issued scarcely any orders once a battle started. So it's hard to believe, but Lee appeared to absolve himself of responsibility for a battle's outcome, considering it his subordinates' responsibility to adjust to changing conditions and win the battle. If his army didn't win the battle, it must have been because God didn't want it to. At 7 days in Gettysburg, for example, Lee again and again issued morning orders and then watched the battles progress without making any real attempt to steer the outcomes. There were more than a dozen instances at Gettysburg when his orders weren't obeyed, and he didn't send anyone to investigate. William Davis explains Pickett's charge. It was his most hazardous battlefield expedient yet, but then his men could do anything. Moreover, when he made any decision, success or failure lay not in his hands, but in his, with a capital H. God meant for the assault to succeed, it would. If not, it did not. Lee and his staff sat their horses on Seminary Ridge and watched the mile-wide ranks of 12,000 men go forward, but from that moment he made no effort to coordinate or direct the assault. 30 years later, Confederate General Lafayette McLaws remarked, "The Battle of Gettysburg has not yet been analyzed to make the combination of movements comprehensible. The disjointed assaults, which could not under any circumstances have produced favorable results, have not yet been explained." So Lee's failure to take control on many battlefields may have been caused in part by the inadequately small staff he deliberately retained, which is another issue. Now, some will argue that what Lee was doing was giving his generals and others the flexibility they needed to make decisions on the battlefield when circumstances are constantly changing, and if they feel hamstrung by waiting for orders from the central staff, then perhaps soldiers will be so hampered by indecision that they can't move forward. So there are arguments on both sides, but at least the way that Lee executed battle really left soldiers in a lurch, and a lot of times they didn't quite know what to do at a given time. All right, so that is the Confederacy. Now let's look at things from the side of the Union. Specifically, the contention that the Union Army waged total war, and that's how they won. And this gets back into the question of, did the overall focus and strategy of the Union Army change, and what does this tell us about the generals? So the contention of some historians that the Civil War was the first modern total war, setting the precedent for the murderous wars of the 20th century, World War I onward, appears to be a different twist of the myth of the Lost Cause. It implies that the Union prevailed by waging war of unethical scope and severity. Charles Strozier says, "It was Lincoln Grant in the Civil War that incorporated total war into modern experience." He adds that the totality of the modern state seemed to require unconditional surrender as a necessary correlative of its total wars. The American Civil War brought that into focus. The accusation of brutality in the Union Army's conquest of the South began right after the war. In 1866, Puller contrasted the Yankees' behavior with that of Lee's army, which he maintained abided by its commander's order to protect the property that lay in the path of its Gettysburg campaign. No house was entered without authority, no granary was pillaged, no property was taken without payment on the spot, and vast fields of grain were actually protected by Confederate guards, he wrote. In fact, rebels in Pennsylvania foraged extensively and confiscated livestock, transportation vehicles, and thousands of wagon loads of grain and produce, sufficient to constitute a 15, 20, or 50-mile reserve train of wagons. Confederate so-called payments for property were made in essentially worthless Confederate currency, and as many as several hundred black Americans were kidnapped and sent south into slavery. By mid-1863, Puller continued, Southerners were exasperated by what they had experienced of the enemy's barbarities in their own homes, and some urged a due measure of retaliation by Lee's army in Pennsylvania. It was not advised that homes should be burned or robbed, jewelry stolen, and women raped in Pennsylvania, an exact imitation of the acts of Northern troops in Virginia and Mississippi, but that a devastation of the enemy's country should be inflicted to teach the enemy a lesson. But Lee ignored such calls for vengeance, writes Pollard, who provided no evidence of or specifics about the alleged barbarity of the Union forces. Jefferson Davis leveled the charge of unconscionable brutality 15 years later in his description of Colonel Benjamin Grierson's diversionary raid from the northern border of Mississippi through the interior of the state. Among the expeditions for pillage and arson, Davis charged, this stands prominent for savage outrages against defenseless women and children, constituting a record alike unworthy of a soldier and gentleman. Grierson's three cavalry regiments kept Mississippians on edge for perhaps 17 days, causing General Pemberton to send thousands of troops to find and intercept them, diverting rebel attention away from Grant's movements, their main mission, and destroyed railroad tracks, stations, and rolling stock, but there's no record of pillaging, and certainly not of attacking or bothering any civilians, let alone women and children. Nevertheless, Davis's lie took root. It's only fairly recently in the 20th century that the concept of total war has been applied to the Civil War. According to Mark Neely Jr., the term was first used in 1948 by John Walters in an article about Sherman for the Journal of Southern History and was quickly adopted by the famed Civil War historian T. Harry Williams. His book, Lincoln and His Generals, began with this assertion: the Civil War was the first of the modern total wars. Other prominent Civil War historians followed Williams down that path. For example, in 1986, James McPherson commented that by 1864, a group of generals, including Grant, Sherman, and Sheridan, had emerged to top commands in the North with a firm grasp on the need for coordinated defenses in all theaters, a concept of the total war strategy necessary to win this conflict, the skills to carry out the strategy, and the relentless, even ruthless determination to keep pressing it despite a high cost of casualties until the South surrendered unconditionally. McPherson explains, the kind of conflict the Civil War had become merits the label of total war. To be sure, Union soldiers did not set out to kill Southern civilians. General Sherman, after all, in his campaign, his March to the Sea, destroyed property, while Allied bombers in World War II destroyed hundreds of thousands of lives as well. But the strategic purpose of both was the same: to eliminate the resources and break the will of the people to sustain war. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. The reality is that the North won by a hard war, not total war. Total war, defined by the wanton killing of massive numbers of civilians, has a long and brutal history, and it doesn't just begin with the Civil War. It was waged by Genghis Khan, Tamerlane, the Romans against the Carthaginians, Catholics and Protestants in the Thirty Years' War, Germans in the First and Second World Wars, and the Russians and the Japanese in World War II. The Civil War largely doesn't belong in this category. The methods, not the strategic purpose, make a conflict a total war. Unlimited, large-scale attacks on civilians, like those in London, Coventry, Dresden, Berlin, Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and countless other cities in World War II, are absent from the Civil War. If Sherman's attacks on property had also included a large number of executions of civilians, they could have been accused of total war. With the intentions of eliminating enemy resources and breaking the will of the people, which are logical goals of virtually any war, doesn't make it a total war. Most of the killings of civilians during the Civil War occurred in Missouri, Kansas, the Appalachian section of many Confederate states, and Texas. They generally were carried out by civilians engaged in local guerrilla warfare and not by organized military units. The worst was the execution of about 150 men and boys in Lawrence, Kansas, in 1863 by William Quantrill's pro-Confederate raiders. Not long after, in 1864, Bloody Bill Anderson executed 24 unarmed Union soldiers pulled from a train, and he slaughtered 127 men in a pursuing militia posse, including the captured and wounded. Perhaps the most common killings of innocents by military units were the executions of surrendering or surrendered black Union troops and their officers in many places, including Fort Pillow, Milliken's Bend, Saltville, The Crater, and Poison Springs, Arkansas. Neither Confederate nor Union regular armies, however, engage in large-scale campaigns that include the deliberate killing of innocent civilians. Civil War armies engage in hard war, but not total war. That evidence deserves more detailed examination. What did Sherman's army really do in Mississippi, Georgia, and the Carolinas in 1864-1865? In early 1864, his army lived off the countryside in his Meridian campaign, a dress rehearsal for the March to the Sea. As they stormed through Georgia later that year, 60,000 Union troops destroyed railroads, torched cotton bales, emptied corn cribs, smokehouses, and seized hogs, horses, and mules. Most significantly, they freed thousands and thousands of enslaved laborers along their path. Sherman's large army was able to live off the country between Atlanta and Savannah because Sherman had studied an 1860 census report on the population, livestock, and agricultural production of each Georgia county he passed through. He later said, "No military expedition was ever based on sounder or surer data." His march to the sea is described in the Oxford Encyclopedia of the Civil War. Sherman's men were under orders to forage liberally on the country during the march, that is, to seize food, fodder, and horses needed to sustain the army. Foraging parties organized daily in each regiment, performing their task with a vengeance. Self-appointed or especially ruthless foragers, known as bummers, were little more than ransacking thieves as they plundered the possessions of rich and poor, of slaves as well as their masters. At a cost of just 2,000 casualties, Sherman's march across Georgia crippled much of the war-making potential and morale of the Confederacy. His army accounted for some $100 million in property damage as it brought the war home with frightening reality to Confederate civilians. The Lost Cause or Pollard had to stretch the evidence to speculate that civilians were killed in the March to the Sea. He described massive damage to, or theft of, barns, crops, furniture, pianos, jewelry, sorghum barrels, and other property. Labeling Sherman's property destruction savage warfare, Pollard continued, "If a property owner escaped and was hiding in a thicket, this was evidence that he was a skulking rebel, and most likely some ruffian, in a zeal to get rid of such vipers, gave him a dose of lead, which cured him of his secession tendencies." So that's not very much to support allegations of total war. Sherman's army continued its destructive progress through the Carolinas in 1865. His men particularly hated South Carolina, the birthplace of secession, and they probably destroyed more property there than anywhere else. The notorious burning of one-third of the capital city, Columbia, was a combined work of evacuating Confederates, burning large quantities of cotton in the streets, high winds blowing up, and drunken Union soldiers, for Sherman had them stopped. All these actions were consistent with Sherman's statements that we are not only fighting hostile armies, but a hostile people, and must make them feel the hard hand of war. There are a few reports of rapes or killings of civilians perpetrated by Sherman's army. A recent study of the relationship between his soldiers and Southern women excoriates his soldiers for entering bedrooms and parlors, as well as seizing personal treasures and letters, in an effort to humiliate and demoralize elite white women along their route. But there's no mention of rape or murder. Being caught in the path of Sherman's army was harrowing, but it wasn't total war. What did Sheridan's troops do in Shenandoah Valley in 1864-1865? They burned barns, silos, crops, and some houses. They stripped the valley of livestock and foodstuffs that had been used to support Confederate troops throughout the war. There was no program to kill civilians, and at most, only a few of them died. 2 years later, Pollard harshly described Sheridan's destruction of agriculture. Of this and other like atrocities of the enemy, there has been attempted a very weak excuse to the effect that if the private property of the inhabitants of the Confederacy had not been destroyed, it might have been converted to the uses of the belligerent government and helps to sustain it. Once for all, it may be said that this excuse excludes every sentiment of humanity in war and may be logically carried to the last extremity of savage warfare. Understatement wasn't a characteristic of Pollard's work. Overstatement became a basis for such myths. Sherman's and Sheridan's destructive sweeps through the South occurred late in the conflict when the North realized it would have to wage hard war to win. Grant realized after Bloody Shiloh in 1862 that a decisive Union victory wouldn't bring down the Confederate governor without complete conquest. In his memoirs, he wrote, "Up to that time, it had been the policy of our army, certainly of that portion commanded by me, to protect the property of the citizens whose territory was invaded. After this, however, I regarded it as humane to both sides to protect the persons of those found at their homes, but to consume everything that could be used to support or supply armies. Such supplies within the reach of Confederate armies are regarded as much contraband as arms or ordnance stores. The destruction was accomplished without bloodshed and tended to the same result as the destruction of armies. Promiscuous pillaging, however, was discouraged and punished. This policy, hard war, not total war, was followed with few exceptions for the balance of the war. The North's approach to slavery exemplifies the movement toward hard war. Lincoln rejected appeals for emancipation for more than a year into the war. He made several offers of compensated emancipation to the border states, Delaware, Kentucky, Maryland, and Missouri, to secure their continued allegiance to the Union. When the need for more Union soldiers and the need to deplete the labor force of the South outweighed the border state concerns, the president issued his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation in September 1862 and his final proclamation on January 1, 1863. Even though Lincoln's emancipation of Southern slaves fulfilled his dual goal and was clearly intended to eliminate the resources and break the will of the Southern people to sustain war, it wasn't an act of total war. It did result in an increasingly overwhelming loss of property, quote-unquote, by the Southern people, and culminated in the 13th Amendment, which Congress passed and sent to the states for ratification in January 1865. In tandem with Lincoln's anti-slavery moves, Congress passed two confiscation acts to deprive the enemy of property. The Confederate Congress passed similar legislation. The Civil War was a mighty scourge, as Lincoln called it, but despite the best efforts of mythmakers, it was not America's introduction to total war. The mass killings of civilians that did take place were the work of Confederate sympathizers. War isn't pretty, but claims that the Union waged total war are a bit off the mark. Well, I think that wraps up this episode, so what I would say is, it's not that generals changed a lot. There were some that swapped in and out that were more effective than other generals. Grant was a much more effective general than earlier Union generals. But competencies of generals didn't change. I think their tactics just changed in the evolving face of what the war was, where it became necessary to wage a harder war from the Union side in order to win, and the Confederacy fought a more defensive war than an offensive war. So it wasn't so much the abilities, but the circumstances that I would say changed. So I hope this answers the question.
All right. Well, that wraps up our exploration of the past for this episode. First off, I want to give a shout out to the Spy Masters for the Knowlton's Rangers. Vic Austin, Chris, Rob Matlock, Alan Baker, Beverly Ingle, Jake Harrington, Todd Warren, William Ivey, Joyce Normant, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Daniel Lawson, Marlene, Michael, Tim Clark, David Powell, Moondoggy from Ohio, Melissa, Chris from Maine, Carl from Norway, and Baron Fraser. I'll explain what that is in a second. If you like the show and want to help it grow, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps spread the word about the show. Two, join our Facebook group. Here we can keep the discussion going about new episodes and you can talk about what you like and didn't like. And you can find this group if you just search for History Unplugged on Facebook. Three, we have an online store with t-shirts, phone covers, and other accessories featuring awesomely bad history puns that were crowdsourced by you, the audience. And you can find that if you go to teepublic.com and look for History Unplugged, or you just go to historyonthenet.com and look for our store there. Four, and this is really the best way to dive deep with History Unplugged, and that's to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you know your American history, you know the Knowlton's Rangers were an elite spy and reconnaissance group in the American Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program of History Unplugged. You can join at three levels. If you join at the level of Scout, you can hear all the episodes of History Unplugged completely ad-free and get early access to new episodes, at least a week early. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get special bonus episodes, like a 10-part series on the World War II hero Audie Murphy, a multi-part series called Ottoman Lives about different people in the Ottoman Empire, and a series called Rendezvous with Death that looks at biographical profiles of Americans who went to fight in World War I before America entered the war. The last level is Spymaster, where you get all that stuff, but you also get three hardcover history books, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, Race to the Top of the World, Richard Byrd and the First Flight to the North Pole, and The Last Fighter Pilot, the true story of the final combat mission of World War II. Another bonus is, you can choose a history topic for me to focus on for an entire episode that can go up to an hour, and I'll answer whatever question you have for me, and you get a shout-out at the end of each episode. If you want to learn how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, go to patreon.com/unplugged. That's patreon.com/unplugged. All right, well, that is all for my spiel. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast, from ancient Greece to the Cold War and everything else in between. See you next time.